You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the show. Stu Goldsmith here. This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast, in which I talk to the great and good of the world of comedy and find out from my colleagues and fellow comedians, and in this case, specifically today, comedy magicians, exactly what makes them tick, how their creative processes flow most effectively and efficiently, and of course, the key question, whether or not they are satisfied with where they are. Today, we are talking to John Vanderput, a.k.a. Piff the Magic Dragon, who you will probably have seen. I think he's done enough of those GT shows, America's Got Talent, Britain's Got Talent, that kind of thing. He has a phenomenal act. It is a genuinely laugh-out-loud, funny act, and he's got a special on the way as well, which I was very lucky to see a preview copy of. And as you will hear in the early part of this show, I am a recent convert. Not to say that, I mean, convert is putting it too strongly, but I really liked what he did when I saw it a little bit here and there. So I'm doing spots and stuff in Edinburgh. I wasn't aware of just how honed it is now, just how imaginative. And also, he's managed to kind of managed makes it sound cynical. I don't mean that. He has earned his place at the table with some of my comedy heroes, including Penn and Teller, as he now works and lives in Vegas and is absolutely banging out 400 shows a year and consulting to people like Penn and Teller and what have you. We are going to find out so much stuff. We're going to find out how he flicked the switch from sackable corporate table guy to the deadpan bulletproof performer that he is now. And we're going to find out why a fear of failure turns most magicians into, his words, hack copycats. Loads and loads to enjoy here. And if you go to the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, you will find another 30 or 35 minutes, I think, of extra stuff, including Piff on the invention of his own tricks and how something new with a block of jelly has already cost him 2.5 years and over $70,000. It's very different magic to comedy, but we're going to get right under the skin of it now. And bless him, I think he got up at something like 5 a.m. in Vegas to record this. So let's all pin back our dragon ears and enjoy this one. It's an absolute belter. This is Piff the Magic Dragon. Mate, I didn't realise I was as much of a fan of yours. I knew what I remembered of you from Edinburgh back in the day was things like the appearing table, you know, the appearing table legs, and then naming the money. You know, your kind of your club set, right? Whenever this was, late 2008-09, something like that, I guess. Yeah. And I remembered, okay, deadpan magician. I like that. I like that angle. I feel like I saw you out flyering in the street.
Oh yeah,
do you know what I mean?
All,
like in
all
the
I did
gear
in Edinburgh. Yeah, just
yeah,
yeah.
And I kind of was like, okay, this guy's doing like deadpan magic. Sure. I've just been swimming around in all your clips and the special you sent me, and I'm your biggest fan.
Aww, like, thanks, Stuart.
Like, I was excited to have you on because I remember you. You've obviously got an interesting story. The little bits I've seen here and there, I was like, oh, great. Yeah, this. Of course, I'll bite your hand off. Having watched that special, it's just brilliant. It's laugh out loud funny, and I don't say that about any magician.
Oh, me neither. Me neither, buddy. God.
So tell me, look, there is so much to talk about. Tell me about the special and tell me the terms about which, like, have you released the special?
Are no,
you
I think we're just about to. I think we're just about to release it. It's a, you know, it's a weird landscape for releasing specials, so it's taken a while. But I believe we're just, I don't know. I'm the last to know. But I believe we're about to release it. Yeah, I like it. I'm really proud of it. It took about 2 years to make.
And can we talk about it? Do we need to keep anything in it secret?
No, we can talk about it, whatever you want to say.
I think it's the funniest I've ever seen Penn, right?
Ah,
like, well, I'm a huge Penn and Teller fan.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan. I've seen a lot of their stuff. And I laughed and laughed and laughed at Penn in that, in the framing of him and the glee that he was having and how kind of off the hook he felt as your surprise guest slash log lost father.
I just can't believe that Penn has his own dragon outfit because of me. First of all, I can't believe I know Penn Jillette. That's one
yes.
thing. You know, I grew up watching Penn and Teller, and I did a show. My big break was doing Penn and Teller Flawless, the original season in the UK, yeah. and I came on the show, and the you know the TV production company were saying, oh, just do, you know, just levitate your dog or something. And I was like, no, I have to make them think. The show is called Penn and Teller Flawless. I have to at least make them wonder how I did whatever I'm going to do. So yeah. I went on and I did, you know, like you say, my club set. And then I ended with a magic trick that's like a difficult magic trick to do. And they really like that combination of like funny, you know, funny jokes and good magic. So they basically adopted me. And that was 10 years ago. They, you know,
that's incredible. Yeah. I didn't know about that. I knew that you'd done Fool Us. I did warm up for the pilot of Fool Us. I didn't go on to do the series.
Yeah.
I say that out loud now. Maybe they didn't like me, but I think they did. I definitely like my memory, my abiding memory of doing that was one guy, bless him, whose trick didn't work. He'd forgotten to switch it on. But apart from that, my big memory of that was Teller saying something incredibly nice to me about my warm-up. He kind of walked past to go for a wee in a kind of recording break, and he just whispered something incredibly positive to me about the warm-up job I was doing for them. And it was huge to me because I grew up with Penn and Teller.
Right.
And I knew that was your big break, but I didn't realise you were as, like, you're friends with them now and they've adopted you and everything.
I'm not kidding. Penn's my best friend out in Vegas. And I say that... Just to talk about how great those two are. I mean, he's literally like, you know, my biggest kind of confidant and supporter out here. So it just blows my mind. And Teller, the other day, about a week ago, Teller and I were working on a magic trick for my show. So, Teller is a genius on a complete, obviously, I'm not telling anyone anything they don't know here, but Teller is a genius on a different level of magic. He thinks about sure. magical methods in a very different way from anyone I've ever spoken to. And Penn has a way of seeing magic that is that really is a completely fresh angle on it, whatever he's looking at. So I can like take, you know, my ideas to both of them, and they have a way of making them 1,000 times better than they ever would have been.
Because it seems to me, as a non-magical person, as someone who, like, I know enough.
But you did, I thought you did a bit of magic.
Yeah, like I could do three sleight of hands in a pub. I could do the tiniest bit of mentalism. But like, I'm the worst kind of magic fan. Like, I know how a lot of it's done without having gone through the practice and the craft. Do you know what I mean?
I understand what you're saying. You know, you have a little bit of the secrets, but you have none of the pain.
Yeah, 100%.
Right.
Yeah. And partly that's because of Penn and Teller, because of growing up with How to Play with Your Food.
Yeah.
That book they wrote where there was a tearaway page in the front that said, everything in this in red ink fucks the trick up.
Yeah.
So tear away this page and then lend it to your friends and they won't be able to do this. And I was like, that mentality is a big deal to me. Like, that's so, so fresh and so punk and so provocative. And I think it's true to say that the magicians, certainly the magicians I know of, as a 99.1% layperson, are the people who have managed to do something different with it. If you think of David Blaine, again, to me, David Blaine is he wanders around next to motorways. He's like the sort of indie guy. And Penn and Teller are the we give the trick away guys. And to me, again, like Derren Brown he's the guy who's convinced you that it's not magic that he's doing.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So now you will have your own opinions on those, I'm sure, and I wouldn't ask
you to... Not that they're
to...
interesting. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, not that my opinions are that interesting. But yeah, no, I agree.
Well, no. Because I'm obviously, I've got kid gloves on here, because what I don't want to do is be like, so I know that magic is a kind of...
Piff the Magic Dragon destroys Penn and Teller. Live
I guess it's worse than comedy in terms of how precious it is. Yeah. Is that a starting point? Is magic more precious than stand-up comedy in terms of how people deal with each other?
It's painful because, you know, comedy is a very sensitive world, because you know you're going up and you're sharing a part of yourself, really. And magic is divided into two camps. I would say the majority of magic is hack, copycats, people who are buying tricks and going on stage without any sort of ability, and just doing garbage. You know, that is objectively speaking most of magic. And as much as I would like to defend it, that's just the reality of it. And then there's a small portion of people who are really trying to, you know, do a good show and do a good thing. But magic is, I just think it's really, really, really difficult. And I'm not, look, I mean, I'm no stand-up expert, but I have chunks of stand-up in my show. Every show I've, you know, done for the last few years has at least five minutes of stand-up. It takes me about 3 months to write it, and then it goes in the show for about 6 months, and eventually it sort of like ages itself out, which is a weird thing with stand-up, where it sort of stops being as funny as it was 6 months ago, which I never really understand. But every night I say the same words, and it gets the same response. Within a realm, and it costs me $0 to make. Now magic takes about 2 years to come up with 1 5-minute bit, like a decent. And I would love to be the one saying, well, it's just because I'm so slow at making magic. But no, you talk to Penn and Teller and David Copperfield. Everyone says it's about 2 years for a bit. So it takes 2 years. And tens of thousands of dollars. It's literally like me saying, hey, you want to do stand up? Great. It's $1,000 every time you go on stage. And you know, and so I actually think the bar to entry and the bar to success is prohibitive in good magic, and that's why you don't see that much of it.
Yes. Okay. That's I hadn't even considered the cost. My take on it was always it takes so long. My apprehension of it was that it seemed to take so long to learn the physical skill.
Right.
A lot of magicians do that when they're children instead of going outside and socializing and building charisma and personality.
That's a problem too. There are many problems. Yeah.
So with that in mind, the point I was building up to is that I recognize that there are people who move it forward, who do something different, who position it differently. And those are the people, like, for me to have noticed a magician outside of the fringe circuit, they've got to be right up there so I can, you know, like, I know that my knowledge of magicians is not huge, is not broad.
No, but your knowledge of magicians is not broad because there aren't many magicians out there doing something that's captivating and interesting with magic. I mean, that's the reality.
So to me, the thing that you are doing differently, and I'm fascinated to know how much of a kind of like a history there is within magic, how much it's accepted that there is a thing of deadpan magic.
Right.
Because, and or whether you'd even refer, deadpan magic isn't sort of even really quite what I mean, but because of the suit lifting your, or kind of allowing you to be grumpy and to eat food in the background and to be disinterested, more than grumpy, disinterested. That completely changes the worst thing about bad magic, which is people wanting you to be impressed. The fact that you don't appear to give a shit whether or not we like it lifts it into like a top 0.5% category. And I'm interested, are there other deadpan magicians? Have other people discovered that in the past? Are you part of a kind of a history of that? Or have you cracked it?
I mean, look, we're all borrowing from the people who've come before us, for sure. But I think that there is something in magic where it's something about pretending to have genuine magical powers that comes with a certain neediness, you know?
For sure.
And I just can't do it. I mean, look, I would love to be saying that all of this is a choice and I very cleverly sat down and considered my options and decided that this was the way forward. But what actually happened was I was being fired every single place I was performing as a regular magician. When I was John, the contemporary magician with the moody shots and the fancy suit doing these private events and corporate dinners. The reality was I just had a resting bitch face and everyone fired me because I was too grumpy to be at their wedding. You know, I mean, that's what this guy came up to me at a wedding. He said, "What is your problem? You're like the Eeyore of magic." And then he was the groom. So he just fired me. That was it. And then one day I went to a party, and it was my friend's party. It was a fancy dress party or a costume party. And I didn't have anything to wear. And I said to my sister, I need something to wear. She said, "I got a dragon outfit under my bed." And I was like, done. So I go to this party. No one's in fancy dress. It's just me. And one of my friends, and then I was appropriately grumpy. And one of my friends said, "You should do this in your act. You could be Puff the Magic Dragon." I was like, "Wait, I could be Piff the Magic Dragon. You might have heard of my older brother, Steve." And I thought, that's a funny idea. And I tried it. And suddenly it made everything about me socially acceptable. And so I didn't have to pretend anymore with the magic. I just could just like be me and say what was ever in my head. And it turns out that was, yeah, I'm going to do this stuff. And if you don't understand it, that's on you.
So I'm, thank you for the condensed kind of like the origin story.
The Cliff
Notes. I was at the Cliff Notes. I was aware of that. But I did, when I first read that as like the origin of the suit and all the rest of it, part of me thought, well, I know enough about magic to know that one of the skills is you create an origin story
right.
and you stick to it like to the
you
death.
Bob Dylan it. But unfortunately, yeah, right. But I unfortunately,
so,
I have
it's
the,
so neat.
Right. Even when it was happening to me, even when I was like in that party, I was like, this is a good origin story. But again, it comes back to I'm a hard worker. That's the one thing I'll say about myself. I'm like a dog with a bone. And I know that when I'm given an opportunity, then there are few enough of them that I've got to make the most of every one of them. So that's the only thing I say. Everything else is literally just like just good fortune. That something's come across my plate and I've like a bear with a salmon just like grabbed it and then and that's what happened at that party. I was like, that is a really good idea, and I'm just going to do this now, because I was literally being fired everywhere that I was performing, and that was my only job. That's it. Really the only skill set I have is doing magic for people who may or may not want to see it, and most of them didn't.
So in terms of the tone that you have, because like one of the things, like obviously phenomenally skilled, you know, you've done you've put in your how many thousand hours.
Yeah, I've practiced.
Yeah, you've practiced.
Yeah.
But the tone that you have is more important, I think, to me and maybe to a lot of people. There's a lot of people have practiced. Not everyone has got the tone. And presumably once you arrive at that, like if pre-Piff, presumably when you were writing material, because you didn't have an angle, you didn't have much of a starting point for material. Whereas once you're A, a dragon, and B, happily
right.
disinterested, they're both incredible jumping off platforms to write anything.
I think one of the things that happened to me was, you know, it takes 10 years to get good at this stuff, right? But I'd spent, by the time I started doing, wearing a onesie, I'd spent like 10 years doing magic and being and I'd sort of found a voice in that, but it was just not a voice that anyone wanted. So I was doing close-up magic in a restaurant in Croydon, and I walked up to this table and said, "Hello, do you want to see some do you want to see some magic tricks?" And the guy slid his chair back across the floor, and he stood up and he said, "My wife has just asked me for a divorce. Do you really think I want to see some fucking magic?" And I said, "No, because she's made half your house disappear." And I got fired immediately. And I was just like, oh, God, I just can't do this. So I had like, you know, I had.
So you had the act and you had the tone.
I had the act and I had the angle and I had the tone. It's just I didn't have that way to make it play. And it was just so crazy that I stumbled across this idea at a party. It took me 6 months to get up the courage to do it. I did it once, and I was like, this is, as soon as I walked on stage, it was like July 5th in 2008 in the American way, because that's the only way I can do dates now. I have to do them backwards. But I walked on stage, and I did it, and I really was like, oh my God, this is what I do now. And so I just dropped everything else, and I pursued it. And it was amazing how quickly it just connected. And like you say, like the right, you know, like suddenly I knew how to write the material, and everything just started working from then.
Where was that? Where was that very first gig?
That was
that in the UK,
in a pub. I used to put on these sort of like comedy nights, and it was in a pub called the Honor Oak in Honor Oak, where I grew up.
Yeah. Okay.
I grew up in Southeast London, so it was just down the road.
So this is Piff and slash John. It's Piff and John. We're talking to John, but John is Piff. I probably should have made it clear at the beginning that he's not in character, as you can hear. Well, I mean, is he not? It's not a character so much as him looking grumpy in a costume. So let's not delve too deeply into that. But I think it remains the case that only Randy the Puppet is the only person who has been themselves on the show. Do you remember the Randy the Puppet episode? Been themselves. I mean, been their character. Where we got to speak to Heath McIver, the owner, creator and operator of Randy. We're not in that kind of territory. This is Piff and John through and through. Reminder to go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders for some more information, half an hour's more stuff from Piff on his own bad magic and his own guilty shortcuts, as well as his evangelist upbringing and what comics can learn from magicians. And on top of that, you also get not only the recent insider-only Q&As, you get, if you're in the Insiders Club, when they crop up, you get to be in those Q&A sessions and ask questions yourself. And if you join it at any point, you can hear the audio from specials with Nish Kumar, James Acaster, Fern Brady, Alfie Brown, and the very recent and absolutely incredible Self-Help for Comedians special with the brilliant Amanda Donnett, holder of 3 degrees, very intelligent lady, and brilliant, brilliant psychologist. And that is, I mean, you remember, if you're a lifer, if you're a long-term fan, you'll remember Break Glass in Case of Emergency, which I think was a sort of the best of the most uplifting bits of the first 100 episodes of this show. That's available on Bandcamp if you care to track it down. But this is a similar, if not very much better and more effective, I imagine. It's a real shot in the arm. It's like a condensed version of how to make yourself happy in the face of things like performance anxiety, writer's block, worrying about how much self-disclosure on stage is too much. And even if you're not a comic, you can really get some incredibly useful, juicy and immediately usable concepts from that episode. So that's all I'll say about that for now. You can find that and all the extra stuff at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Email me at info@comedianscomedian.com or get in touch with me on various socials at ComComPod. Thank you for all the correspondence. I know how much you love the one with Rosie Jones. I know how much you love the Greg Jenner one. This is an absolute banger. Also in the can, we have Josh Johnson, fabulous, very exciting, very, very funny comic in the States, who has a new mixtape concept special coming out soon, as well as a show on Comedy Central, which I don't think you can get in the UK, but you'll be able to find it. Just get Googling Josh Johnson. He's amazing. And that one's a belter. Paul Zerdin is another. We've got Piff and Paul Zerdin in the same month. Brilliant, brilliant ventriloquist, and certainly worth looking at his incredible stuff online. And two or three more very exciting people coming up who I won't mention until they are safely in the can. That's everything. Let's get back to Piff.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
as a magician, is it important to you to be inventing new tricks? Or is it, like, which is the most important thing to you? To kind of leave behind a legacy of, like, that's a John trick, that's a Piff trick.
First of all, there's no legacy. Listen, we're all dust. we're all dust in a few years. And
I agree with you.
And I'm all for it, by the way. The idea that the pressure of trying to leave a legacy, you know, I had a friend of mine, and they're an actor, and they said, oh, yeah, I stopped doing theater acting, and I only want to do film because I want to leave a legacy. And I'm like, oh, my God, that is a lot of pressure. No, a forgotten footnote is what I'm going for.
But someone like Copperfield, you would think he wants to leave a legacy, right? Do you think?
Yeah, but that's right. But hang on, but that's David Copperfield. You know, like that's a, you know, I don't even know who's the comedy equivalent of David Copperfield. Carlin? I don't know. Pryor? Maybe Pryor. I don't know. He sold more tickets than Michael Jackson.
Did he really? Holy shit!
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's like there are these mad statistics about David Copperfield that will just blow your mind. And he still performs 15 shows a week, whatever it is. I can't remember, 42 weeks a year or something. So he does 700 shows a year. It's madness.
So do you feel like... do you feel like you fit in the room when you're in the room with Penn and Teller and David Copperfield?
No!
Hanging out in a magic bar. Do you, because like you have been phenomenally successful right now. And I know a lot of that is you've got great marketing, you've got a great angle, all of your copy is brilliant because a lot of it arises. I remember the first time in Edinburgh seeing that billboard that said loser of America's Got Talent.
Right.
Like you know how to sell yourself, you know?
Right.
So I imagine there is somewhere on the spectrum of, oh, you absolutely have a place at the table because those guys all respect what you're doing because what you are one of the tiny percentage of people who are doing something different. You have made it from, you know, from an outsider origin to having, you know, residency at Vegas or the rest of it. And somewhere on the other end of the scale, and these things may be true simultaneously, is your sort of kind of a grifter, right? Like you had a hustle. Right. You are trapped eternally inside a floppy green cage of your own making. God. Like
yes.
Part of the joke is this is pathetic, which is really hard to pull off. And you often see, if you think of people who made a transition from being like a sweaty fringe act that was all about madcap chaos, you put it on TV and it doesn't work. It doesn't look right. And all the magic dies. You found a way to kind of take, I'm going to turn being pathetic, like not acting pathetic, but the tone of like, this is a bit crap, which is so British, and make it fucking smash in Vegas. So to what extent do you feel like you've earned your place? And to what extent do you feel like you're a hustler and you could get found out any day?
And the truth is somewhere in the middle of that because the act doesn't work if it's not good.
Of course.
You know, like most things, but this really like, and I've done those shows over and over again. I've gone out with like the material that's not ready. I've gone out with the tricks that aren't good enough or the jokes that aren't good enough. So I've proved over and over that this doesn't work unless it's like killer. And also it's like, there's also something like when I did stuff like Penn and Teller Fools or America's Got Talent, there's something really funny about going into somewhere that has $100 million of production behind it and performing in a stupid dragon outfit that really is actually probably a crocodile that you know, I'm like so I feel like I've put in the hours in terms of getting on stage and working at things. But I also feel like people like Penn and Teller and David Copperfield, they have genius. There is an element that they just think in a different way than I do. And I'm happy to be the light comic relief. I'm happy to be the the sassy sidekick at those brunches, always coming up with the hilarious quip. You know, I'm like the Melissa McCarthy in Bridesmaids of that group. You know, and that's my place, and I'm very glad to be there. But yeah, I mean, that's the crazy thing about I'll tell you a story. I mean, it's like I was dating this girl in the UK and her parents hated me. They just hated me. And, you know, it got serious and we were like together for a long time. And I, in the end, took out her mum for lunch and I said to her mum, listen, like, we're going to be together. So the more you and I can get on, we can figure out how to make this like relationship cordial, the better for everyone. And she said, well, it's nothing personal, but we just feel like you're going to become more and more successful as a magician. You're going to get your own show in Las Vegas and you're going to leave our daughter. And I was like, if there's one thing I can promise you right now, it's that I will never have a show in Las Vegas. Because there I was as like this, like, you know, like I've been doing magic for 10 years and I was fired everywhere. I just started out on the comedy circuit. I was finding my way. And the idea that I would like become a like Las Vegas headliner, it was so, I mean, it was beyond ludicrous. And then now, like, we've literally just changed rooms in the Flamingo Hotel and Casino, and we're in the main showroom there. It's like an 800 seat venue, and it's bananas. It's bananas, and I just cannot believe that this happened.
And talk to me then about the mechanics of Vegas for you.
Yeah.
So you, like, what was the little room that you were in? Was that your first residency in Vegas?
Yeah, that was the Piff the Magic Dragon Theater. It was like a 200 seat venue, and everyone was crammed in like a, and it was definitely a violation of 19 fire codes, which is the best room for comedy.
You know, of course.
The closer you are to death, the more.
And that's, sorry to interrupt. I totally agree with you. Calling it the Piff the Magic Dragon room or the Piff the Magic Dragon theater, is that, I sort of feel like, is that a bit of Vegas kind of flim-flam where it makes it sound like you have your own theater, but really it's a studio? Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of...
Yeah, right. It's a venue. It's like a 200-seat like room where people go to watch shows. And I don't know. Yeah, they named...
But the nature of a residency is they call the venue after you while you're there.
Oh, yeah.
But it sounds to the casual listener like they've built him his own venue.
Exactly. But it is, right, that is the weird thing about Vegas, is that the theatres are not like, the acts don't pass through the theatres, most of them. You know, there are a few like that, but most of them are like, they house like specific shows. So like the Penn & Teller Theatre is like, the only show there is the Penn & Teller show.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's like, it's all marketing and all that stuff. But yeah, I was in this tiny room for 5 years, and we really built it up over the 5 years. And then when the lockdown happened, when everything shut down and everything, it was pretty clear that we weren't going to go back to doing shows with the audience shoulder to shoulder. So, yeah. And we'd actually been busting at the seams in that room. So I was like, well, it may be that we get a chance to sort of move up to a bigger room. And, you know, we have the ticket sales now to justify it. So I started working on a much bigger show. And last October, I was the first headliner back on the Las Vegas Strip.
Come on.
Performing in the pandemic. It was bananas.
Talk to me about the schedule. You work, how many shows a week do you do?
Right now I only do six. So that's kind of a part. I do like Thursday through Monday and we do two on Saturday. But when we first came back to do shows, we could have 250 people in the theater, which is not too bad. And then there was, you know, the numbers went up, so they reduced it to 50 people in a 800 seat theater, which is 6%.
Oh my god. And you must be the only act who can cope with that.
Oh, I love it. There was a club. Did you ever do the Playboy Club in London?
I don't think so, no.
It was more like cabaret acts, but okay. No one would play it because it was a nightmare. And so I would just be able to play it every single week. And I would always be like, yeah, any gig, just send me any gig. I'll happily bomb anywhere, but I want to try and get good at the tough gigs. So yeah, a show for 50 people in an 800 seat room, I'm all in. And they're all masked and, you know, 25 feet from the stage. So at that point, we were doing 10 shows a week. But and before the whole shutdown thing, we were doing about 400 shows a year with a mixture of like almost 300 in Vegas and just over 100 on the road.
Okay. So and is I like that, doing can shows. You, like, the thing about Vegas that I only really have a sort of vague understanding of is it's the place where you do shows all the time. It's
yes.
Edinburgh every day of the year, say. Is there probably that's, the nearest that's thing the I, best, I can kind of
that's the best analogy. It is Edinburgh every day of the year.
And I think I want that.
Right.
Did you think you wanted that? And how I know, is that?
I know I wanted it. I know I wanted it. So
and how is and it I love when it. You're it's like a day job? It does it feel like a day job? Does it solidify into a this is how my day works? I'm just gigging every single night for my entire life.
Well, there are two things. First of all, magic is not like comedy. It's not like sort of like Jerry Seinfeld stand up. You know, when Jerry Seinfeld's doing stand up, then he's written the jokes. Uh-huh. You know, he's honing it and then he's reciting it. Magic, you basically got a loose cannon on stage with you multiple times throughout the show, who at any moment could ruin your life. At any moment.
The volunteer, so, this is.
Yeah, the volunteer, yeah.
Yeah.
So the dog, I was talking about that dog, no. The volunteer. So it's like a golf swing. It's like every night you're trying to hit that perfect golf swing, and every night you do it to a lesser or greater degree. And then you've got to like connect the shots because that's like the different tricks. So the idea of doing a perfect show is never going to happen. You're never going to do it. And there's a part of my brain that's always engaged, that's always in the moment with magic. And again, like I say, I have about 5 minutes of stand up in the night. And that is when my mind wanders because I'm saying the same thing each night. And that's the moment when I really have to like stay present, as opposed to the moment when I've got some, you know, some person from the audience who could just send the whole thing tumbling down.
That's fascinating.
So that's why I love doing it every night.
In the special, when I saw the bit, that there's like a chunk in the special at a similar rhythmical place, I imagine.
Yeah.
When you do some stand-up, it was like, oh, just stand-up stuff. And I wondered whether, like, does the impetus to do that come from you wanting to prove to yourself that you can still do the stand-up? Or is it, or that you're still connected to that world, or you're capable of it, or is it that it's cheaper in the budget of creating a show? Right. Do you know what I mean? Like, where does that come from?
I love stand up. I've always loved it. I love being able to do it. I never felt I would be able to do it, and so whenever I go out and perform stand up, I'm like, oh my god, like this is great that I can do what my heroes have done. But at the end of the day, people want to see tricks, so I only get a small window to do it. And it's a magic and comedy show. Sometimes it's just magic, and therefore sometimes it's just comedy. But most of the time I try and get that hybrid, which is a difficult hybrid to get. But I'm actually working on just putting together a stand-up hour, which I think would be hilarious. Just putting out maybe an EP or something as, just audio stand-up. So,
audio, just audio.
Yeah, just stand-up. Audio. I think
so. No suit, no nothing. No dragon, or still the concept
of the
dragon.
No, I'll perform it in the dragon, but okay. I'll release it as audio only.
I love the idea. I love it. And there's a lovely bit in the special as well when you're doing magic for the visually impaired lady.
Oh yeah,
and just kind of bullying her.
Yeah,
so great. I love the idea of all audio magic. That's glorious.
But that's when I did that thing I did magic for. I mean, she was essentially blind. She could see like I think it was like six inches in front of her eye or something. And that's the crazy thing is like you can't write that. And we were able to capture that on the special. So,
and do you, when you're helping other people with their tricks, what do you think are the, like, what do you think is your skill set in the room? What do you think when people go, do you know who we need? John or Piff, you know, we'll get him in because he'll be able to bring the what flavor is it that you bring? Like if I was to say, oh, I've got to work on some one-liners, you might think I've got to, you know, if I've got to sort of let's get Gary Delaney, let's get Adam Bloom, you know.
Yeah.
So what thing is it you think people come to you for?
I don't know. I used to do a lot of magic consulting, and the one thing I hate about magic is the method, because it's the barrier between me and getting on stage. And to get a really great method is very, very painful and is solitary. The other reason I love stand-up is because you can work it out in front of an audience. You know, you can get up there. I did in Edinburgh one year, and I did a show called, I can't even remember what it was called actually. But it was just about, it was an hour. I didn't wear the dragon outfit. I just went on stage and talked for an hour. And it was a little bit like origin story with a little bit of sort of anecdotes thrown in. And I loved it. I turned up at, I think the show was like 4 p.m. I turned up at 3:59 p.m. and I was on time. And then I finished. I did 55 minutes. And I said, thank you, good night. And I walked off stage and out of the room and I was done. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I was doing the work in front of the audience. So, you know, by the end of the week, the show was, the show was pretty funny, actually. Magic is not like that. It's like you turn up hours in advance and there are no answers on stage. If you don't have the trick going on stage, you're not going to find it out there. So you have to work on that on your own, usually. And sometimes you can persuade somebody else, but that other person ends up being a hostage. You know, you're both hostages to trying to persuade magic to let you out of the room. And I worked with Penn & Teller for a year, and I saw pretty early on that my job was to say the stupidest idea of the day so that everyone else was free just to come up, just to say any idea, because nothing could be dumber than what Piff the Magic Dragon just came up with.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I'm so happy to hear that. That's completely kind of in keeping with, I don't know, what I hoped or what I anticipated.
Now, one of the things that I'm very passionate about in magic is that it's okay to fail. Because magic is not, again, it's not like comedy. If the magic trick doesn't work, you fail. The audience will turn against you and you are not good. You know, in comedy, if one of your jokes bombs, then that's like maybe like, you know, you can recover from that pretty easily. And you don't have that in magic. And as a result, there's a culture amongst magicians that failure is bad. And we know that there's a culture in stand-up that failure is not bad. Failure is like part of the journey. So, I'm kind of passionate about the fact that magicians should fail a lot more. And it's that Beckett thing of like fail better. So,
yes.
And so
they're scared. Do you think magicians are particularly scared of failure then, because it just seems to connote disaster?
They're scared of it and they also stigmatize it. So if you fail, then people are like, you're rubbish. And I've had that over and over again when I was coming up. Then there were plenty of magicians who and still are, who will be like, oh yeah, that's dreadful, and they're right, because they saw me, you know, like bomb somewhere, or they saw a trick not working. Again, with magic, it either works or it doesn't. It's binary. It's not like comedy where it's comedy can definitely be not funny, but it can also be a bit funny, quite funny, really funny, hilarious. Oh my God, that's killer. Magic is either on or off. So, you know, I've done plenty of gigs where the audience saw how the trick worked and therefore there's no magic.
Yeah, that's the thing stops existing, doesn't it?
Yeah, and people only ever see, you know, they often only ever see one or two or three shows of yours. So there are plenty of people out there going, I saw Piff the Magic Dragon and he was dreadful. How is he in Vegas now? What has he done?
Do you think there is a link between your stand-up roots, obviously, and your acceptance of failure being a part of the process, and the fact that when you fail as Piff, because you haven't promised.
Right.
Like you like your emotional engagement is different because you're eating a banana at the time. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like you do not appear so invested. You are personally invested, but you haven't gone all in on the personality of promising them this is going to be great. So you've given yourself effectively a permanent escape route to an extent. Obviously,
right.
If you need it to work, it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But you don't have the sort of the additional kind of body horror of going, it doesn't work, and therefore I feel like a failure.
Yeah, I can get away with it, which was very useful when I was starting. But I'm not, you know, it's like Tommy Cooper is occasionally the trick would work and that would be the surprise.
Yeah.
Whereas imagine if you were saying that about David Copperfield, you know,
yeah.
I mean, once in a while, he does vanish the Statue of Liberty and it's great when it happens, but you know, you don't go expecting it.
So, but do you think that's true then?
Yeah.
It's easier for you to risk failure than a lot of magicians because of your tone.
100%. And that was a decision I took early on, was that I could be like a quote unquote joke magic act. But then I think the whole thing sort of collapses in on itself. And if there's anything I've learned about Jell-O, that is a bad, bad.
How do you mean? You mean because you're funny, the danger is you let the skills slip. And you are less kind of pioneering,
right.
Less innovative, and then you simply become, he's a funny guy.
Yeah, people expect the magic to be bad. You know, I walk out in a kid's party magician suit, you know. And by the way, I thought when I was at that party years ago and said, you know, I could be Puff the Magic Dragon, I thought that would be a funny 5-minute bit. And my only dream at that time was to be in shows like Le Clique or La Soiree and do a 5-minute bit. And the only thing that I, you know, the only thing that stopped me from doing that is I just kept having ideas and I kept thinking, wouldn't it be funny if, and that's kind of continued. I didn't even think I'd be able to get to an hour long show, and I've done, you know, a bunch of them now. So, but one of the decisions early on was, this would be much funnier if the magic suddenly crushed and everyone was like, wait a second, how the hell did you do that?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And you, in terms of how you build out the world of Piff, that's something I was really impressed with in the special, because not only have you got, you've got Mr. Piffles, the Chihuahua.
The OG, he's still the same one.
I didn't want to ask. There were a lot of listener questions about that. There's a lot of people saying, surely it can't be the same dog.
It's amazing.
Other people saying, the dog routinely died during the show and was buried. And, you know, I mean, there's an Edinburgh show they saw where the dog had supposedly died.
Oh, yeah. I used to kill the dog every night. And I used to, when I did that in America, I had a montage video of like these like glamour shots of Piffles set to The Wind Beneath My Wings, you know, the song from Beaches. And, you know, I would kill the dog. What would happen is I would get an audience member to shoot the dog out of a cannon and the dog would die. And I'd frame the audience member for murder in order to hit on their girlfriend or wife or whatever. And which actually I've kind of like really pulled away from that whole side of like, magic is like, there's such an element of magic where it's like what's that thing that people use? Pickup artists. Remember that?
Yeah.
And they used to use magic as a pickup technique. And so when I started, like, I was like, you know, oh, I'm going to do some ironic pickup magic. And, and definitely in the last sort of, I don't know, 5 years, I've just gone, nah, that's not interesting. Let's not do that anymore. Because, you know, the idea of, like, magicians hitting on, you know, even, like, funny magicians hitting on audience members is, like, done to death. But at the time, that's...
Big gap.
Yeah.
Go on, sorry.
No, at the time, that's how I would do it. I would, like, frame... I would murder the dog in order to frame this guy, in order to hit on this girl who would then reject me, leaving me with the ashes of my dead dog. And I would... There's a famous trick in magic called the salt pour, where you take a small handful of salt and you pour it out onto this stage and it continues pouring for, like, 3 minutes. So I would do that with the ashes of the dog. And then out of the ashes, I would then sweep them all together and produce Piffles in a sort of like, in an angelic angel costume. But yeah, I would kill my dog on stage every night.
when it comes to those kind of issues, like the pickup artist thing and the fact that, like, because magic does, it can seem sleazy.
It's not.
Magicians don't have a great reputation as human beings.
Because they've earned it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why they've, it doesn't come from nothing. It's like, hey, what are you guys going to do? You're going to saw a woman in half? What kind of dick move is that, you pricks? And by the way, when I say you guys, that's already a big problem, you know?
Yeah.
So in my mid-20s, I actually had a theatre company called Stand Not Amazed, which was like a magic-based contemporary theatre. And, oh, my God, I mean, talking about pretentious, it was so far up its own ass. But one of the things that was interesting was being able to, like, take magic illusions and spin them on their head and be like, why are we even doing this in the first place?
Yeah, okay.
So I quite enjoyed that
part. There's a big debate about a year ago, I noticed, amongst on Street Performer Facebook, whereby people were talking about the gag where you kiss the female volunteer on the cheek.
Which I used to do. I did it on...
Point at your cheek. Yeah, right.
I did it on
America's
Got Talent.
Just to explain for the listener what that gag is, they then, you motion on your own cheek. This must date back 5,000 years, this gag, you know.
Right.
You motion to your chin and the female volunteer kisses you, and at the last minute you turn your head and kiss her on the lips.
Right.
For me, growing up as a street performer, oh, a hoot, outrageous. Oh, it's 2021. That's not cool.
Right, right. And it is not cool now, and it was never cool then, and I used to do it every night. And I was performing in a comedy club in LA, and the owner was like, "Oh, I don't want you to do that." And I was like, "Whoa, why are you being so sensitive?" You know, and I did it on America's Got Talent, and it was like one of the things that people like always remember. And being able to have some distance from it, I just go, "Nope, nope. Mm-hmm. Why would you do that to somebody?" You know, why would you put an audience member who has volunteered their vulnerability, why would you ever put them in that position? But, I mean, it's just ignorance and stupidity, really, and taking the easy route out. And now, that's one example of that. And then the other example is like, oh, I'm just going to do a card trick that I bought from the internet because it gets a great reaction. You know, that's a sort of like... less charged version of it, but it's all like the same problem.
When I was talking earlier on about building out the world of Piff, so you have Jade, in the special, you have Jade, the showgirl, and I can't remember the guy's name.
Francis.
Like the kind of
Francis
stooge,
the Squire.
Francis,
yeah.
Of course. Apologies to Francis. As well as Mr. Piffles. And then this is the cave I live in and those kind of things. It reminded me of a conversation I had years ago with Louisa Omulan, who was smashing Edinburgh doing what would Beyoncé do. And I remember saying, you know, I was suggesting that she could look to what Beyoncé does as things that could be fun elements for her to play with, to either, you know, either at one end as merch or at the other end as like ideas for material for shows. Like, if she's Louisa Omulan, she should probably have a fragrance. Do you know what I mean? Like building out the world in that way. And I really enjoyed those elements of the special and of your work where you're like, what would... You know, every so often you hear them talk about, you hear Steve Coogan saying, what would Alan be up to now?
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And kind of like trying to work on those bases. I don't know. I don't know if that's really a question, but just talk a little bit about the world building of Piff.
I just think, you know, there's something maniacal about magicians where they just suddenly decide to build empires out of nothing.
I totally agree with you. I've got a theory as to where that comes from. What's your theory?
That we're all mad. That we're all egomaniac, narcissist, psychopaths, really. But you know, Dolly Parton has Dollywood. And I just, you know, one of the early things that I thought of, it would be hilarious to have Piffland. And so I have those tendencies. I definitely also have a gap between me and those tendencies, which other magicians may not have, I believe. but I still have the tendencies and therefore guilty as charged. But I just think the idea that you're going to walk out on stage and say, hey, everyone, I have magic powers, is so ridiculous that I was like, I need a way to frame this in order that the audience, that I can, like, you know, sleep at night. And for me, that was a lucky idea. You know, I'm going to be Piff the Magic Dragon. Yeah, I'm a dragon who does magic. What's the problem? And so once I started with that concept, then there was sort of no end to the madness. Then it really was like, oh yeah, well, obviously I'm a dragon, so I need a princess, I need a knight, I need a squire, I need a castle, I need a cave, and I've got to sleep on treasure. And so all of this stuff, it's like, it's, they're funny things to have, and then they're funny things to sort of play against as well.
Yeah. Do you, just as a thought experiment, if you, I don't know, we would need to contrive some situation in which you could never be Piff again, what would your feelings be about building something else from scratch? Like, you know, you see a puppeteer who gets massive success right. with one particular thing, and then they maybe get a bit bored of it and go, oh, now it's me and this guy. And the audience goes, huh. Like, is that the thing we fell in love with?
Yeah.
Like, what do you feel about that?
I don't know, because I don't feel... Look, I mean, there are some things that I've been a part of that are unequivocally genius. You know, it's definitely genius to get a magic performing chihuahua and win the hearts of America that way. Unfortunately, I didn't plan any of it. I just stumbled across it and I made the most of it. And so I feel like I will never, you know, I could never like create that from a blank page. So I just, and also some of the best ideas are things that other people have suggested to me. And I go, God, that is a genius idea. My work is like massively collaborative. You know, I have a whole team of people that I work with. The best ideas come from the group. And if anything, if I have a skill, it's being able to pick and choose from other people's genius. So I do question whether I would be able to come up with something, you know, from a blank page. But equally, I also have learned to trust the process rather than, you know, the blank page. Because at the beginning, I just look at it and go, oh, well, this is garbage. We just did a show last year called Tournament of Laughs, which we had to make. And I always talk in the plural. Is that what we is?
First person, you mean like the royal we?
The royal we, yeah.
Because, I don't know what it's called.
Yeah, whatever that royal we is because it is. It's like, it's me, it's, you know, Alex Jarrett, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Alex and I have been like great friends for, I don't know, 9-10 years. And so,
okay.
You know, Alex is a massive part of my collaborative process.
Okay.
So him and I, we did all these like videos for this Tournament of Laughs thing together. And every week we'd have to start with a completely blank page and within a week come up with this this madness. And we did like movie, you know, fake movie trailers. And I did a stunt where I set myself on fire and turned into a chicken. You know, and it's like, and I look back and I go, and that was with Stuart McLeod, who is a genius. He's another, you know, from Barry and Stewart.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 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 I knew the name. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I've learned now to just trust the process, not have a panic attack in the middle of it, which is what I enjoy doing. You know, at least three a day, a good three panic attacks a day will get me through. But I've learned just to really trust it now and accept that eventually this will get good.
I think part of that response kind of is really important, that sometimes the genius is in recognizing that collaboration provides the genius. And like you said, making the choices, making the decisions between, yes, I'll do that, Piff will do that, Piff won't do that.
And I think also it's like there are people who are genius. There are, oh my God, I just saw James Acaster's new special. Mm-hmm. I mean, the man is like, I don't even understand how he's coming up with that material and how he, I mean, like those three specials he did back to back. I just don't even understand how you film that. you know, without a teleprompter that you're just reading from very carefully. It's like, so there are, you know, I see talent like that, pure talent. And obviously those people are taking that talent and just honing it and working on it like massively. It's like, you know, Penn's a huge Bob Dylan fan. And, you know, when they have the Blood on the Tracks notebooks and every song has gone through 10,000 revisions or whatever it is. But I still am convinced that there is a spark there. There is a spark of genius in those people that is absent from me. And therefore, I have to work, as hard as I can in order to be in the same, to even be in the same room. And I'm okay with that because I like the work.
I'm fond of asking people what quality got them where they are, if it's not your comic ability or your magical ability. But I guess you've already answered
it's
that.
It's stupidity. It's arrogance. It's, you know, the arrogance of even thinking that I can do this. It's privilege of, you know, going, oh yeah, I could just be a magician for my life. You know, that, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's like, you know, like most people, 99% of people are like, yeah, I think I need to go and get a job. And I was lucky enough to be, when I really came up with the act, it was like a year and a half where I really developed it. And I house sat for somebody, and I didn't earn any money for a year. And I just had a friend who, they were a lawyer, and they were away for a year. So I was able to live on, like, I don't know, £1,500 for a year or something. Without that, I wouldn't be able to do this.
How do you cope when things go wrong? When magic goes wrong, or when you're in the creation of magic, when you're frustrated, when you can't do it, you're in one of your panic attacks. I mean, how serious are you about the panic attack?
Oh, no, very serious.
Do you mean you're a bit of an edgy person?
No, I have like, on stage, I love it when things go wrong. I love it because it's like that's the time that it's different for me, and it's a puzzle. And I'm like, how the hell am I going to get out of this? I give you an example. I was doing a show in DeKalb, Illinois, which is just outside Chicago, and it was a big theater, a lot of people there, and the dog was solving a Rubik's cube, and I looked down, and the dog hadn't solved the Rubik's cube. He just hadn't. In fact, he'd mixed up the Rubik's Cube so badly that there was no way to recover. And I was like, oh, shit. And at that stage, a bat got loose in the theater. And I was like, huh, there's a bat loose in the theater, everyone. And everyone turned around to see the bat loose in the theater. And I said to Jade, hey, Jade, would you go and get that bat, please? So she got a big, you know, a big trash bag, and she was running around the theater trying to catch a bat. Meanwhile, I was on stage unsolving and resolving a Rubik's Cube because that stupid dog had ruined it. And then they caught the bat. And then I said, oh, where were we? Oh, yes, the dog was about to solve a Rubik's Cube. Take it away. And the dog solved the Rubik's Cube. So that's the element that I love, because you could never imagine that. That scenario happening.
And the love of that, I mean, it's obvious that's a really funny outcome. Presumably there are times when you didn't manage to nail it. Something went wrong and you didn't manage to nail it. Because that's a wonderful kind of random success story. And I suppose what we can learn from it is that by kind of face planting into...
Right.
By being unafraid, if something goes wrong, like you said, you've practiced enough now that when something goes wrong, you can fix it on the fly. You can change what you claimed was at stake earlier on. And make the, do you know what I mean? So the trick ends differently, or it becomes a different trick. So you've got, you are well versed enough. So is it just experience?
Yeah,
if a thing goes wrong, I can work it out.
I think that's why I like it on stage, because most of the tricks I've done every which way, so I know all of the problems that I might come up with. And I can usually figure out a way on stage to make it happen. You know, I'm very present when I'm on stage. So I really enjoy that part of it. I enjoy the heckler who is decided that today they're going to try and ruin a dragon. You know, I sort of welcome that and embrace it. And it's what the audience responds to as well. So You know, one of the things is that can every show be the show that people go, oh my God, I saw Piff the Magic Dragon once and a bat got loose in Chicago. You know, and trying to create, because there's so much improv in the show. So, and I have like the audience is like characters to me. The audience, you know, I have like, now, like I say, it was a big thing for me to let go of that thing of like, I'm going to hit on somebody in the audience. Cause that's such an easy magic trope. And so 5 years ago, whenever it was that I let go of that, then it became, well, what do I do now? So now there's like one villain in the audience. So there's always like, there's one cynic in the audience who I'm spend the whole show trying to convince that, magic is something to be embraced. And then there's a couple who have like, apparently in my eyes, they're on the edge of breakup and I'm the only one who can save them.
Okay, that's nice. You know, that's a nice angle.
There's a kid who like his only one Christmas wish is to be on stage of Piff the Magic Dragon. So like I have these like roles in a show and then it's like building a kind of a one act play every night where all of this stuff comes together. And so I really enjoy that challenge of it. And anything goes wrong, the nice thing is that it could very easily fit into that, you know, oh my God, I can't believe this has gone wrong. And look at this guy, you know, the cynic who like, look at him, he's like, oh really, Jesus, you just turned water into wine. Guess what? I'm a recovering alcoholic. That's very insensitive. So, sure. You know, there are all those different elements. So anything that goes wrong makes the show memorable to me. So now in this part of my career, I love it so much. Whereas before it was just painful. It was like, oh yeah, this may not be resolved.
And you were saying, I felt like you were about to say it's off stage when things go wrong. That's a different kettle of fish.
Yeah. Well, I mean like, maybe like 2% of my work is on stage. And 98% of it is off stage. You know, there's no secret that headlining a show in Las Vegas is a lot of work. So, you know, when you said, "Oh, I've wanted to do this podcast for ages," so I was like, "Hey, can we ask Stuart if we can do this?" And you said, "Okay, I can do 1 p.m. whatever bullshit time it is for you, you know, after your mid-morning nap or whatever, you know, after your late brunch, you know, I'm more than happy to get up at 5 a.m. and do a podcast and then, you know, spend the day working because I know that it gives me the edge that I need because I don't have that touch of genius. I mean, I remember reading about, you know, Michael Phelps, the swimmer. Yeah. You know, yeah. He worked out that if he trained on like the holidays, on Christmas and all this stuff, that would give him like a 0.5% edge over his competitors. And it's that sort of insanity that I try and edge towards in order to give myself the biggest chance of success on stage.
Is that workaholism?
Oh yeah.
Is that
none
is
of this
healthy?
Is healthy?
Or does it feel compulsive and weird?
Oh yeah,
like you
chasing the perfect show is like chasing the perfect high, you know. And I'm like, I'm a massive addict. I spent my 20s in various. I was actually sick when I was 22 to 26. I had chronic pancreatitis, not from alcoholism. So therefore, you know, chronic pancreatitis is one of those diseases you get no sympathy from. Because everyone thinks you brought it on yourself, but I had a tube missing in my pancreas, and they said, "Well, it basically hurts a lot, so have all the morphine you need." And it turns out there was no bottom to that.
Oh God!
To that, I was like, "So I'm very aware that I've got a very addictive personality, which I just like to rather than trying to battle it, I try and direct it into." Something a bit more useful, like stupid dragon tricks.
And I was asking before about the anxiety about panic attacks. Is that a real thing, like real actual panic attacks, or just that?
Oh yeah, when I grew up, I had massive panic attacks about which I think is the only sane reaction, by the way, about being you know, about the idea of God and heaven and hell. I had massive panic attacks because that concept is so terrifying. And so I think whatever that is, that's sort of like, that was baked in enough as a kid in order for it to translate through the rest of my life. And so, you know, so then it becomes about managing it. And again, I mean, James A. Acaster says it far better than I could when he's like, when he talks in his special about, oh yeah, everyone has problems and we should just talk about it and that's okay. So, you know, I have to have, I have to manage it. Otherwise it becomes, otherwise it's always there. So the only choice is, do I ignore it and it like becomes a real problem, or do I do the best I can to tackle it head on and manage it? And that's what I, that's sort of my approach, but it's a nightmare. And then, you know, I say to my parents, you know, my mum's side of the family is pretty sane, but my dad's side of the family is all over the place, you know, with a clear history of this. And it's like, oh yeah, it's just I guess that's what it is.
And are there any particular, like, panic attack, other than that principle of direct the energy into something else and talk about it, except those two principles, are there any particular, have you got any, like, kind of techniques or kind of off-the-peg things you could share with, like, this is what I do when I feel one coming?
Yeah, I'm right. I mean, thankfully, the coping mechanisms are out there, and it is just as stupid as breathing correctly. Mm-hmm. And meditation and not overloading myself with a bunch of things. But I mean, also, it's like, it's also tricky because probably not being a Las Vegas headliner. You know, because there's so much pressure in that. But it's like, hey, you're going to do what you're going to do. So, you know, yeah, it's like, it's just asking for help and making sure that, you know, I see a doctor like every other week.
Okay.
Just to like check in and make sure everything's fine, because otherwise, I mean, I had a friend of mine who killed himself 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, out of nowhere, and it's not something to be toyed with. You know, it's not something to be taken lightly. So I don't take that chance. I do everything I can to look after that side of my health. And, you know, I don't see, like, when I was growing up, I was ashamed of that part of my myself. But now, like you say, I see it as the addictive side of my personality as being the flip side of the coin of, hey, I can work really hard. And I can get to like live this crazy dream of being able to perform my show every night in Las Vegas, and it's full of all these mad ideas that I had and somehow brought to life on stage.
Here we go. Well, the first one is from Lawrence Wheatman, and it is, what are Penn and Teller really like? And that seems like a sort of trite question, but let's see if you can answer it, given you're pals with them.
My friend says about these things, everyone wants the story to be, oh yeah, the massive dicks. Like whenever anyone says like, hey, what's he really like? Then the only answer that people are interested in is that they're massive dicks. No, Penn and Teller have been like, they'd be mentors, best friends, like incredibly generous. I've been, Vegas has not been a smooth journey for me. I've had the ups and downs. When I first came here, I was signed to a 10-year contract to be a small part in a big show. And after 6 months, that show ended. And it took me a year to get another gig, which happened to be my own show. And that was a year of not working. So, you know, during that period, they were there for me and adopted me and, gave me work, suggesting terrible ideas in their Las Vegas magic show. And I think, you know, I spent a year working for them and they used two of my ideas. And those ideas were tiny minor parts, but they kept, you know, they kept saying, hey, come back next week. So, I mean, they're just great, great people.
Are you happy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm so glad.
Yeah. I get to... yeah, I mean, it's just incredible, all of this stuff that's happened. And you know, at the beginning, when I started, my only dream was to be in Le Clique, or La Soirée, as it became. And so that happened early on. So everything else has been gravy. And, you know, obviously, like, I want to keep moving on to the next thing and the next thing. And like with a special, you know, I go, oh, my God, this could be a real thing, like there's a really rich world to be explored on TV for this act.
Definitely. And the special really proves that. It's such a great piece of work, and it's such a great calling card.
Yeah.
And it is just completely full of, hey, TV people, look at everything I can do with this. The tone with which you're doing a trick for those guys in the work helmets and stuff, and doesn't blow them away, and you do this kind of fake voiceover of them being impressed, is all of that. It's just, mwah, love it.
Yeah, well, thank you. No, I hope we'll get it out there soon. But yeah, I'm very happy, and I've got the best co-star in the world, Mr. Piffles, who is a constant source of joy. I've never met anyone happier to see me than that dog. It's unbelievable.
You're the first double act I've spoken to. The first double act I've spoken to with a non-human member. And Mr. Piffles seems very well treated. And I know from Ali Cook that there are huge amounts of legal precedents in place to ensure that magicians' animals are well looked after.
Yes, there's also just the dignity of a fluffy little dog that is to be protected at all costs.
Mate, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So that was Piff. Thank you so much to John for coming along and for getting up so early. I say coming along, switching on his internet, but doing so in a very early place. And you can see... What am I going to... Oh, no, I know which image is accompanying this episode. I've got the video of this, and he's wearing a costume throughout and with an incredible animated background. So I might find a way to get that to you as well. But find out everything you can about Piff. He's just, I mean, I love his act, and I really hope the special gets the reaction it deserves when it eventually comes out. So excited to talk to him. Thanks to Piff. Thanks to Nathan Wood for editing and uploading the show. Thanks to Jake Crossland for the logging. Music was by Rob Smouton. Podcast consultant steadfastly remains Peter Dobbing, despite his recent lack of interest in the show. He's got his own... Oh, I'll find out from Pete whether I can link to his... he's been doing a lockdown project, a really interesting series of videos about kind of the creative moment or the sort of flair moment in lots of different industries. So I'll find out and link to them in the show notes if I can. And that is all of that. I'm talking fast because, as ever, I've almost run out of time for a post-amble. I'll do a very short one in a minute. But thank you, everybody. Remember, if you are a LinkedIn business person, hook me up on LinkedIn. I've got material on this now on stage about the fact that for some reason my weird, nebulous, gaseous career is... means that on stage I'm not hawking for people to follow my socials, I'm hawking for people to add me on LinkedIn. But there we are. Feel free to do that. It's Stuart Goldsmith brackets Comedy Insights, and you can find out all the other stuff I'm up to. Thank you for joining me on that platform and sharing and re-commenting and rebroadcasting the material that I'm putting on there. I'm really enjoying doing this 30 days of resilience challenge, which is no longer killing me. So I have learned and taught myself the resilience that I claim to. Thank you for listening. Post-amble coming up now. Comedianscomedian.com/insiders for all those extra bits and bobs and loads more stuff. This thing about the block of jelly that's cost him 70 grand is mwah. Bye for now. I had such a fun experience today. I did a thing for the Juniper Trust, which is an organisation, a charitable organisation that works with a small select group of underprivileged young people in Scotland and tries to give them opportunities and networking and sort of searches for, I don't know, I won't go into detail on what it does, but it's really impressive. And I highly recommend you check out the Juniper Trust if you are that way inclined. But I was invited to talk to them, not about the resilience stuff that I've been doing, but about creativity, which is so exciting because I've got these three things. I've got resilience, I've got authenticity, and I've got creativity. When I say I've got these three things, I've also got soul. But what I mean is I have presentations on all of those things. And the creativity slash problem solving one is pretty new. It's pretty nascent. And I was using this as a sort of an opportunity to get to grips with some of that stuff and also to kind of fine tune it and add different modular bits here and there. And I just had such an exciting time. It was so great. So what can I say about that? I suppose the thing I learned from that, which I had loads and loads, reams and reams of material and ideas, but I actually built the thing in quite a hurry whilst including in it that one of my big tips for creativity is to do it against the clock. Just start immediately, set yourself a 20-minute timer, and the sort of the reframing of putting yourself, of having to do creativity against the clock is incredibly useful. I think that's the basis of the Pomodoro technique, if you've encountered that. So I was sort of pulling it all together very quickly, going into it with genuine, like I'd managed to genuinely convert the nerves or recognize and reframe the nerves as excitement. So I felt really excited going into it. And then this weird thing happened whereby I had notes to refer to on the screen. Yeah, this is one of the lovely things about presenting these remotely. These days in pandemia times, that you're able to have a cheat sheet right below the eye line. But I didn't use it for ages. And then I really noticed myself drop a gear and then go, oh, now I'm looking at my notes. But it was one of those things. There's a thing I say to people if I'm kind of mentoring them or if people want sort of help with presentation skills, which is that rather people are often terrified that they'll forget stuff. I share that, I share that fear. How will I remember what I'm going to say? And the thing I say to people is just try to win the argument. Like, you don't, not that it needs to be antagonistic in the sense of that kind of argument, but just try and prove your point. Just try and make your point and prove your point. Because when you're having an argument with someone in the pub or a conversation about a movie you love, you don't need to prep it in advance and write down all your notes. You just speak from the heart. Only that concept of like speaking from the heart sounds very highfalutin. And actually, all it really is, it just means, there's multiple tangents here. This is a post-apple. I'm not claiming this is serious and planned or anything. But so much of trying to get your point across, I'm really sort of fascinated. I'm spending a lot of time trying to articulate what I mean to people in various contexts, this being one of them. And you get to hear a fun version of it where I struggle and flip and flop around all the place. So thank you for opting in if you have. But so much of it seems to be, you remember at post-amble a couple of weeks ago, I talked about a big sort of therapy breakthrough I'd had where I realized that I knew how I needed to feel about a particular challenge, but I didn't feel it. I just knew it. And so knowing it kind of wasn't good enough. I just knew it, but I didn't feel it. So I couldn't activate it and I couldn't actualize it. I mean, so much of this language is sort of torturous, but I couldn't just start. I couldn't change until I felt it rather than knowing it. And I think that's the same when you're trying to explain a thing to people. So much of the stuff I did today and the stuff I've been doing with businesses and what have you and the stuff I've been doing mentoring when I was doing the working lunches. Thank you to everyone that came for a working lunch last year. So much of it is just about trying to explain something incredibly easy in a way that, or incredibly clear, incredibly simple. And the mission is just to get the message across. And sometimes you find yourself thinking, how can I get the message across? I can whisper it or shout it or sing it. It doesn't matter. All that matters is that they understand it. And so what I had before I kind of reverted back to notes, which was still sort of fine, but I really felt like, oh, I understand this now. I was doing that thing which I always tell people to do, which is to try and win the argument. So my fear is that speaking for 45 minutes, like if you've got absolutely no notes and it's not a script that you've deliberately learned, you're simply saying there's five things to creativity, I think, and they are this, 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 and this, that I just tried to win the argument. And I did win the argument. I came away from it. They had a great time. Feedback was lovely. I was really electrified because I felt like I won the argument, except it wasn't an antagonistic argument. The argument was all about creativity, self-belief, community, resilience, all those things that I love talking about. It just felt like, you know, we talk about this on ComCom sometimes. You have an idea for a joke. You find a way to tell that joke and the planets align. You know, you have an idea about you have an idea about love and you talk about it through the medium of cycling. And once you find that premise, like the attitude is, I love being in love, just to pluck something that sounds like bad comedy out of the air. I love being in love. And the premise is, I love it even more than I love cycling. And then you go, oh, great. And then you're starting doing, making up jokes about love and handlebars and love and brakes and love and padlocks and what have you. This is the worst example ever, but you get my point. The planets align and they really felt like they did today. So I'm just, you know, I'm pretty happy. I'm pretty happy. And then I shut my laptop and walked outside, collected the Boutros to take him to a swimming class. And he flipped out, had a go at me, and it brought me right back down to earth. So there's that. Do I need to mop up anything from that? Did I say everything I meant? There's more to find there, isn't there? There's more in the idea that explaining something to someone. Here's my, okay, so my friend John, hello if you're listening, John. He works in a proper thing. And I met him 10 years, I can't name it. It's a big institution that you know, but I won't name it. And years ago, I said to him at a house party, when I was the first or second time I met him, I said, what do you do? And he said, well, you know, like, he said, you know, this will date it. It was something like Winamp. Do you know what I mean? It was something like a music player, not quite iTunes, proto iTunes kind of thing. He said, you know, those things that play MP3s, that program, you know, you can make it look like anything. Like it can look like sort of the bridge of the Starship Enterprise, or it can look like just a completely boring blank black and white web page. You can, it can look like anything. And I went, yeah. And he said, well, I do that. You know, the way I've just explained to you how things can look like different things. I do that for a variety of things. I could have fallen over. I was like, oh my God, you have just explained to me that you explain things to people by explaining it really well. You dress things in certain ways such that people can understand them, like the example you've just given me. Fantastic. And I think more and more I'm really enjoying doing that. I'm really enjoying fluency and being articulate, and because when you are articulate in the right way, people stop just thinking they agree with you and they feel they agree with you, and then you can help people effect change. I've gone mad and turned into some sort of guru. I mean, I haven't, but this must sound balmy. Thanks for sticking with it if you have. I tell you, the other great thing that happened is I did a proper gig back. I'd done a preview, like an hour, like a solid hour preview to something like 14 people, which was fun and indoors. And that was my first indoors one this year, in proper doors. And then I did like a tough new material gig for sort of 25 minutes that was wonky and didn't make me feel good for one reason or another. And then last night I did half an hour of actual stand-up in a temporary structure, but a structure with proper lighting and a proper stage and 100 people in, and blow me down, I'm back, baby. And it was so thrilling to not be in a drive-through, to not be in a sort of courtyard, to not be in a tent. We were in a tent, but it didn't feel like a tent. It felt like, oh, this. Oh, yeah, this. I riffed up a load of new stuff. How much time do I sit around pondering creativity and trying to make it efficient and trying to make the process efficient? And then what you really need is a cooking room and some, you've been great for 10 minutes and you just start improvising and you find a load of stuff and naturally say a load of things you actually think. And there it is. And you go, well, there we go. That's the beginning of more stuff. So look at me, full of the joys. I said this would be a quickie, but I got on one and now it's 16 minutes later and I'm knackered. Goodbye.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.